in some controversial situations.
This is Dr. Stephen Wright, the president of Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, February the 15th.
Okay.
It's very cheap.
Is it really?
The whole thing is $119.
Fantastic.
And it works very well indeed. Oh, I didn't forget that. It'll pick up 5, 6, or 8
feet
away, you know. We don't have to worry about it. We just didn't forget. I'll have to put on a button service, though. It would help. You were about to say that this diversity in Negro leadership began at what time?
I think it can be dated with the death of Booker T. Washington in 1915. He was the last of the Negro leaders in the sense of a towering figure who allegedly spoke for the great majority of Negroes in the United States. Before he died, however, he was being challenged for that leadership vigorously by Du Bois, as you doubtless know, historically. And since his death, there has not been, in my judgment, any single person, but a whole multiplicity of people who led in little ways, some in big ways, but no one who speaks for the whole group.
There's no official figure, in other words.
That's right.
Can you speak to this question for a moment, Dr. Wright? We hear the phrase, the new Negro, and I'm not talking about the one of, you know, the Langston Hughes period, about 30 years ago or something, or 35 years ago. I mean with the now, the current, quote, new Negro. Or, this question gets very peculiar answers sometimes. They don't agree with us as to what is the origin of this, not the phrase, but the phenomenon behind the phrase.
I realize that there is a great deal of disagreement as to whether there is a new Negro. I'm on record, however, as saying that there is one.
You're in the book, I read it.
And I believe that there are many new things about the character, the aspirations, the methods, the sense of success deriving from the efforts thus far, which in effect has created a new Negro, a Negro dissatisfied in much deeper ways, and I suspect more volatile ways, and a great deal more willing to do something about it.
How would you define this?
Excuse me, just one second. When you go out, I'll point to you.
All right, sir.
You too cool?
No, I'm fine. Fine.
My smoke annoy you?
No.
I'm in a better smoke.
Thank you. Very kind to think of it, but that doesn't. Let's see. We were on the question of
a new Negro.
The description of the new Negro. You had given some description of him, but could you give him more of a profile?
Don't know whether I could do it well right off the top of my head. But I think, first of all, he tends to be young. He tends to be the product of a great deal of a background of effort. He has a belief that he can change the pattern that has characterized the Negro for 100 years.
He's changed the conception of himself. Is that one part of it?
He has a very marked change conception of himself. As you doubtless know, if you go back far enough, it was hard to find Negroes who were really confident, self-confident, who had, who believed that they could achieve in this country, that they could create the kind of climate in which they could achieve, who felt that they could do something about the status of Negroes in this country. And I think there is a very deep-seated belief among millions of Negroes, and particularly the younger Negroes, that they can change it, and that they are willing, if you will, to undergo such effort, hardships, as may be involved.
How much does this penetrate, you think, the mass of Negroes? Now, we know this elite, but how deep does it penetrate the mass of Negroes? Because this varies, no doubt, from one part of the country to the other.
I think it does, but I think that it has penetrated the masses of Negroes. They are not as philosophical about it as the more educated Negroes. But I think that the March on Washington is one dramatic example of some of this, and many of the people there, as I'm sure you know, were not the elite. I have seen over the southern region over the past 5-10 years many examples of people who are not the elite become the backbone situations that promise change. This was true in the court cases that led up to the 1954 Supreme Court decision. There was never any real difficulty involved in getting plaintiffs, even in difficult situations like Clarendon County. I sat in courtrooms as an expert witness myself and seen for myself people who were there, who were interested, who were the witnesses, in addition to being the ones who supplied the plaintiffs and cases.
Let's take the other side of that for a moment. There's an opposition, to a degree anyway, to integration movements, to our civil rights movements, from certain vested interests among Negroes. We know this. I can even read now, I have a list of editorials I have read by Negroes. For instance, the president of the business organization of St. Louis said integration will set back, you see, business 20 years. Things like that. And there are various other types of vested interests. And even the withdrawal, to a degree, from civil rights movement of the prosperous middle and upper class of Negroes, to a degree. Is this changing?
I think it is.
It's more involvement in
And I think it is for the very reason that's involved in the answer I gave you to the question a moment ago. It's going to be almost impossible in this country, in my personal opinion, for Negroes who have a vested interest in segregation to maintain their positions, because they're going to be ostracized in the process. I think it's also a myth that such integration as has occurred has hurt Negro business. This is not true. As one example, the Negro insurance company is better off now than it has ever been before. It's better off, I think, because very many more Negroes are able to buy insurance than were ever able to buy it before, and to buy it in greater amounts than ever before. The Negroes who own businesses by virtue of the improved economic status of the Negroes they serve, and some of them serve more than Negroes. Excuse me, I'm trying to cut this off.
In the last few years in Nashville, has there been a change in some degree of involvement from the prosperous and withdrawn Negro? Has he changed his tone?
I'd rather put it this way.
All right, sir.
There is involvement by the most successful Negroes on the basis of any criterion I know, than there has been at any time for which I have personal knowledge. And this has been particularly true over the past 4 years.
Since
the sit-ins. I'm sure you have learned in your interviews here in Nashville that the involvement of the educated class of Negroes was deep in this community. I recall, for example, on one afternoon when we had 27 students in jail, that within an hour, one physician raised through other physicians in the community a $5,000 bond for Fisk University students. I remember also on one afternoon at the end of a whole week of trials, the Negroes posted bond in the amount of $45,000.
Yes, that's on the record.
That's on the record. And this money came in large measure, or if not exclusive measure, from Negroes who had the money to put out, or the security.
Yes. In some cities, the doctors have been notably uninvolved.
They were deeply involved in this instance.
I just wonder why the difference.
Nashville is a little bit different city in a lot of ways. It's an educational community, as you know so well.
Yes.
And many of the doctors are connected with Maher Medical College. Their social sensitivity is, I think, very high. Their involvement in many activities in this community is extensive. I can't speak with too much authority with respect to other communities where the doctor per se is concerned.
Now your position on the sit-ins and all that's clear and on the record from some long back. In general, it's said by word of mouth, I mean people I talk to, and it's in print here and there, that the academic profession has had to withdraw from the civil rights movement. The Negroes in the academic profession tended to withdraw, or at least lie doggo, you know.
I think this is more true in the state-supported institutions, Mr. Warren, than in the private institutions, for very obvious reasons.
Yes, some obvious reasons for that.
The concern about reprisals is one thing, perhaps the dominant thing. Fear of reprisals with respect to appropriations has been a very real thing. Fear of reprisals with respect to actual loss of position in the Deep South has been a second thing. But I think it would be incorrect to say that this is characteristic of the person in education that is not subject to immediate reprisal. The public school teacher,
yes,
obviously has had to walk with some care.
They're vulnerable.
That's right.
What I was really thinking about is not the person who is subject to simple practical reprisals or terror being terrorized.
Right.
I was thinking of something a little different, which is certainly common in the white academic world. A refusal to be involved on some out of some yearning for respectability, some yearning for keeping the hands
clean
out of the muck of the world. You know,
I don't believe this
clean.
I don't think this is true among the Negro teachers that I know personally.
A lot of white teachers have it.
Well, that I think that's a different situation, which I'll comment on a little later. But for instance, in the March on Washington, there were three or four of our faculty members there. Our faculty here, for instance, issued a statement which was published in the Nashville papers.
Yes.
But this is on the one faculty There have been numbers of Negro teachers who have walked the picket line, some in state colleges that I know as a matter of fact. And I can't think of a single college community where there has been any sit-in or demonstrations where the Negro teacher, particularly the college teacher, has not been involved, and this has been true even in some of the state colleges in the Deep South. Now, for a member of a white faculty, I think the problem is a little bit different, at least in this respect. There is a prestige quality where the Negro teacher is concerned, associated with his involvement in this. There is approbation from the group of which he is a part that goes to him. I think that I'm not, I think that I'm right in assuming that there very well may be disapprobation for white teachers who get too deeply involved, because this is not a cause that has either social or status rewards for the involvement of white teachers in the southern region. I think that he is likely to be looked upon as a little odd. There are some who are courageous enough to do it, and I'm not, and I admire them. But this is still not the thing which is going to move him forward in his profession. And it may have very real dangers, whether these dangers are the kinds that are direct or not. I wonder if I'm clear.
You're perfectly clear. Mr. Silver seems to be doing all right, Ole Miss.
He's a very unusual person. I've heard Mr. Silver speak on two different occasions. He's eloquent, he's courageous, and I think in most of the instances that I have heard him speak, he's been correct. But you can't find a dozen Silvers in the southern region if you try.
That leaves this notion. James Baldwin writes in his last book, this is almost a quote, "The southern mob, according to the testimony of those best qualified to speak the truth, that is, those who are actually involved in the civil rights struggle in the South, the southern mob is not the expression of the will of the white majority in the South. It only moves in to fill a moral vacuum." That's roughly it's a good paraphrase, and it's close to a quote. How do you respond to that notion?
I'm not sure I understand what you said. He said,
the southern mob, the people who get
it's not an expression.
Punch the pickets and get around the high school in Little Rock and New Orleans and that do not express the will of the southern white majority.
Right.
But the mob exists to fill a moral vacuum. That's his phrase.
Yes. I'd rather say it differently.
Well, that's
I've read this is from The Fire Next Time.
That's right.
Right. I don't think that the mob actually expresses the values of the great majority of the South. I couldn't believe that. But I think there is not a sufficient amount of indignation against that mob, and that the mob is permitted to succeed in its efforts because there isn't enough by way of, I'd rather put it this way, there aren't a sufficient number of people who are willing to stand up and be counted with respect to their views. And I think they, in a sense, fear reprisal also. You take a book, for example, like Sarah Patton Boyle's The Desegregated Heart. I think she illustrates as clearly and as honestly as anyone could how much reluctance there is to stand up and be counted in this issue. This means, of course, that there is no restraint upon, or too little restraint upon, the expression of the worst element in the southern region. It's only when the expression of that mob gets to obviously bad points do the leaders, the power structure, move in. Let me illustrate this.
Please.
In 1957, when integration came to the Nashville Public Schools, Casper was in this community, and he engaged in a series of the most vitriolic, rabble-rousing kinds of activities you could conceive. Very little condemnation of Casper. One newspaper in this community condemned his activities forthrightly. One did not. When one of the schools was bombed, the leaders of the city of Nashville were mobilized overnight, and there's been no more Casterism.
Yes, he went to jail.
He went to jail and was subsequently convicted. But that school need not have been bombed. I doubt very much now whether Casper or anyone like him could come into this community at this particular time and move around with the freedom and silence that characterized his coming in the first place.
Now tell me this, in the time of the sit-ins and the boycott, a little later, is this true? There's one version that I have heard. As long as the picketing was entirely peaceful, as long as there was no friction, as long as there was no locking of arms or blocking of doorways, as long as there was no possibility implied of resistance, of actual contact, nobody cared. As soon as it began to get a little rough, the mobs began to assemble, and this began, the real friction began. Then the people of authority in the community acted. Is that roughly the story?
I don't think that is exactly correct.
Well, do you mind telling me?
My version of it?
Your version of it, yes.
I think this is more nearly the fact. As far as I'm aware, those who were doing the picketing never engaged in any kind of violence at any time. I could be misinformed, but I don't believe that I am. But I think that when the size of the picketing began to interfere with business in the community, because there was also fear that there might be violence, did the authorities move in. Of course, I don't think there ever needed to be such violence as did occur in the city of Nashville, because I don't think at that time that the police were seriously trying to protect the students from the reprisals of those who resented their picketing.
Now, one person who's prominent in the civil rights movement here and knows about the picketing and so forth, or should know, and I'm trusting he does, he said there's a real split in the police force on this matter.
That I don't know.
I don't mean in policy, but in action.
Yes.
And some police trying to do an honest job, and others would actually encourage the...
I'd be greatly surprised if that were not the case, because the Nashville Police Force basically is, I think, a very decent police force. And if there weren't those who were very much interested in doing their duty, as officers to preserve and protect the peace, I should be very, very less surprised. But when an order came to arrest these students, I don't think the police officer had any alternative except either to arrest or to
He had no choice there.
Right.
But I'm protecting the students from assault.
Right. Now some
by the crowd, the white crowd.
Right. Now some did make an effort to do this, and some did not.
That's the point I'm getting at.
That's right.
There was a split in the attitude of the actual police force. The question of where they...
Incidentally, on
yes,
that
please.
Point, I issued a statement that followed the first mass arrest of our students. And I was disturbed in that statement by the fact that there had not been responsible protection of the police. I'll be glad to show you a copy of it.
I'd love to have a copy if you have it. I have seen the statement, but I haven't got a copy of it.
Yes.
I had a newspaper report. I've seen the full statement.
I'll pull out one for you.
Fine, I'd love to have it. The question behind all of this, I suppose, is at what point does a threat of violence evoke remedial action on the part of the white community? At what point will they step in and move toward a reasonable adjustment? Now, in Jackson, Mississippi now, some of the people there, some of the white people involved in the civil rights movement, some who are not involved, simply spectators in town, and some of the Negroes I know there have said, there's no way to resolve this but short of the big bloody collision.
I don't believe that.
This place would have to have the drama of the collision before there can be a resolution.
I think this stems solely from the failure on the part of the police and the authorities to exercise their responsibilities as elected officers of all the people. There hasn't been a single instance of which I have any knowledge over these past 4 or 5 years, in which the persons in power have said, there isn't going to be any violence in this community, and it's going to be the responsibility of the police force of this community to see that there isn't, where any violence occurred. And the moment the authorities have spoken and meant it, the violence has disappeared.
That's true. But is it true of Jackson, Mississippi?
To the extent that it's not true in Jackson, Mississippi, then my first point holds that this is a responsibility which devolves upon the officers of the community, the leaders of the community, and if they want to use the threat of violence to keep the demonstrations from going, then they will. I don't care whether it's Jackson, Mississippi, or any other town. I think this is the point.
The threat of violence against the demonstrators
is frequently used as a method of control.
It is indeed.
A method of reprisal.
It is indeed.
And to argue, as some of the governors of the Deep South do argue, that there is going to be violence if this occurs, is merely an invitation to it. The moment the governor says that I am going to maintain law and order in this community, so long as any demonstrations that are conducted peaceably, we aren't going to have any violence. And I don't believe for one moment that it is necessary in this country to have bloodshed to establish the rights of Negroes. This I do not believe. Our minds can go back 20 years ago when the trains were segregated and almost everything that you can think of in the South was segregated. And so many of the people who thought they knew or pretended that they knew said none of the things which have now occurred could occur. But they have, and nobody pays any attention to it. I eat in a restaurant in Atlanta, Georgia. I remember when it was impossible for you to walk with comfort into the white waiting room in Union Station in Atlanta to send a telegram or to buy a newspaper. With someone wanting to know, couldn't you move a little faster, or actions to this effect. I simply don't believe it, Mr. Warren.
That a man I know in Nashville, who's an old citizen here, said to me in 55, if this situation were not being exploited for personal reasons or political reasons by certain people, it would solve itself in no time. In Nashville's talking about. He went on to say that after the violence was over, the violent detentions were over, the fifth column of decency, white and Negro, would take over.
I don't believe any of these problems solve themselves.
Nothing solves itself.
I think that social change occurs because people make it change. And the beautiful thing about a democracy is that it provides the means, I think, by which it can be done without revolution in the sense that we usually use the term. But it doesn't happen unless someone puts pressure somewhere. The pressure can be political by means of the vote. It can be economic. It can be through the courts of law. It can be sometimes by, not sometimes, but frequently these days, by demonstration. But change is a response to pressure, however it is conceived.
Indeed.
And the more intelligently the pressure is applied, the more widespread or the more effectively it is applied, the greater is likely to be the response to it. And every single one of the, I shouldn't say every single one, because in some communities, the pressure was anticipated and changes were effected. But in a sense, even the anticipation of pressure is a use of pressure.
Sure. There's a matter of the nonviolence, the kind of pressure to be applied. I attended the conference on nonviolence at Howard University last November, and I was struck by the temper among a great many people present to repudiate the approach associated with Martin Luther King. Talk of the brinksmanship of violence, disruption of social organization, like jamming at the police telephones and things like that, total strikes paralyzing a community, or even violence short of the lethal. As though to be pursued. And the prediction freely made by many people that if the Civil Rights Bill was not passed, that would be the real thing on the streets. Now, of course, Mr. Farmer said, if you take the streets on this issue this time, you are courting disaster, you see. Every shade of opinion was there. But there was a very strong body of opinion, far, far in the direction of not nonviolent action. A big body of opinion. It's tended to be the young, of course. It tends to, you can almost say that age makes the difference. But this opinion was strongly present. And this opinion is one I encounter in other places, you know. Louisiana, Mississippi, Washington.
Mr. Warren, I believe myself that in every activity of this kind, that you apply no more pressure than is necessary. I hate to use a quote of Carter Glass in a sense,
yeah.
But he said on one occasion that you don't use a cannon to kill a gnat. I'm a great believer in exhausting reasonable procedures before any kind of drastic pressure is placed or applied. I think if we look at, or examine rather, every breakthrough that I can recall, there's been a variety of differences in the amount of pressure that was needed to be applied. I have no illusion that, but that the breakthroughs in Mississippi, Alabama, sections of Georgia and Louisiana are going to be difficult. That it's going to take a longer time. It's going to take a greater variety of pressures. But I have no doubt about the outcome. And I think all of them can be done short of violence. You doubtless know that there has been a voter education project in the southern region.
Yes, I'm acquainted with some of that.
Right. That it has begun to make a difference already in a number of communities. The going is roughest in Louisiana. And I would suggest that if you have the time, that you talk to Wiley Branton, the director of that project.
I know who he is. I haven't talked with him yet. I've talked with people like Ronnie Moore and people like Robert Moses and people working within that whole.
That's
whole,
right.
But actual field men
right.
out there organizing on the spot.
That's right. But to see it in perspective and to see its effects in perspective, I think you would be greatly benefited, as I was, for example, listening to a recent report by him.
Well, he's on my list, and I'm writing to him and trying to see him on my trip to.
Don't miss him.
He's now in Atlanta.
Right. He's attached to the office of the Southern Regional Council.
Yes. Of course, they have been very helpful. The Southern Regional Council has been very
helpful. Yes.
In setting up apartments for me and
right.
giving me leave.
Well, they know, they are as knowledgeable in this area as any group that you can find. And you will find the staff, Southern Regional Council, in my opinion, a factual group, a sober group, a knowledgeable group. And you can find, I suspect, more authenticated information in an office like this than you can anywhere else.
Let me try a quotation from Dr. Kenneth Clark on you.
I know Ken.
I don't know him yet. I hope to soon. This is in relation to Dr. King. Philosophy. You may know the passage. I have it right in my hand here. Since you can't read my writing, I'll try to read it.
I might be able to, I'm a school teacher.
No. On the surface. Sure.
Well, it isn't a major tragedy.
Well, it's not major, but I'd like to have you say again. I won't read the quotation again because you know the quotation. But I should like to have you comment, please, sir, on Dr. Kenneth Clark's remarks on Dr. King's philosophy. What you said before.
I hope I can say it as I said it before.
Well,
it'll be the same. I was saying that from the standpoint of the psychology of a human being, that I have to respect Dr. Clark's position because it is not in the nature of man or in the instincts of man, to put it that way, to be unresponsive to mistreatment. On the other hand, I very deeply believe that the human spirit can be inspired to reach very great heights. And I think a man has to decide for himself where his values really lie. if the cause for which he works is big enough, then whether the things that happen to him as he strives to achieve that cause do damage to him, he forgets. I also said that what King is preaching is absolutely consistent with the whole idea of the Christian ethic, and that if you commit yourself to Christianity, you are indeed committed to love your enemies. And if you cannot do this, which is difficult to do, and no one has ever denied that it is difficult to do, you're not a Christian in the sense that Christ taught us to be Christians. Well, I guess I better say attempted to teach us.
Yes. Let me ask another question in connection with that. If you ground it on Christian beliefs and Christian ethics, that's one thing. But is there a possibility of grounding nonviolence on psychological grounds as different from the Christian doctrine?
I think so.
Actual personality.
I think it can. I don't actually know, but I think it can. As I said a moment ago, I think, for example, adversity can have different effects upon people. It strengthens and toughens in crucible fashion some men, and it destroys others. Some fulfill themselves through the adoption of nonviolence as a philosophy and a way of life. I've seen young people, for example, who come to believe in this, undergo all kinds of things. And those that I have had chance to talk to in depth since, I think are better people by virtue of this. And I think that here I can speak with some degree of authority as a layman. In terms of what I have seen, I may not have had psychological insight sufficient depth to sense any neurotic effects from this. But some of these young people have developed poise. They have decided for the first time in their lives that something worthwhile is worth sacrificing for, and sacrificing in personal terms for. Am I clear?
It's very clear. Do you distinguish this sort of justification, the Christian on one hand, then the psychological justification for nonviolence, from the tactical use of nonviolence?
Yes, I do. The tactical use of nonviolence has victory as its objective. At least I think so. And those who advocate it as a tactic may do it without reference either to its Christian consistency or to the personal values to be derived from it. It becomes then an instrument in the same way that voting is an instrument.
Or that violence might be.
Or violence, precisely, might be an instrument. And I have the feeling that this is a part of the use to which it is being put. I'm not objecting to that. I'm simply recognizing it as a fact.
There was no objection to it. I mean, right. As Dr. Abernathy said in a conversation with several people, one asking the question similar to this, and he said, well, I think that we Negroes in the South, are committed to nonviolence on the grounds of Christian ethic. And so he gave a slow grin and said, besides, the white folks have more guns.
and he's very correct.
This leads to another point, though, about Dr. King. several people, including again Dr. Clark, have said that Dr. King is admired by the white population because he lulls them into a false sense of security. This is a paraphrase, not a quote. But they like to think of the Negro as nonviolent. This lulls their fears. This thinks, well, it's going to be pretty all right after all. It won't be much trouble. How much of that do you think is
true?
Is true.
I don't see how any white person could be lulled into a sense of complacency by King.
Well, I don't either, but I'm struck
yes,
with this.
Yes, King is a master at the metaphor. He is gifted, in my own judgment, with the ability to disturb conscience. He's also gifted with the ability to create an issue in a community and bring it to a point where resolution almost has to take place. And if I were a Southern white segregationist, I would be more afraid of King in one sense than almost any other type of Negro leader.
Do you think that it's actually been a shock to the conscience of white people from King? Some people, yes, clearly, but how much do you think this is an important point?
This is difficult to assess. Probably shock is too strong a term. But I think that he has sensitized the consciences of many Americans, white Americans, who had never been confronted personally with what is involved. And I think that a part of the response that King generates in the white community derives from this. I think it is difficult for a white Christian, and speaking of one reasonably well educated, to completely reject the logic of King.
You are saying then by extension that there's a fundamental split in the soul of the white man on this issue that can be appealed to. He knows somewhere that he's committed to a notion of justice in terms of political instruments like the Declaration of Independence. He's also committed in Christian terms, insofar as he lives in that heritage, to something segregation violates. But he's living in terms of the split.
I think this is correct. And I think that what King does is to make untenable the reservations that he has with respect to the full application of his Christian beliefs and his democratic beliefs.
Tell me something else, speaking of splits. I encountered this notion first in reading Du Bois many, many years ago. The split in the Negro psyche, which has many formulations, but I'll paraphrase it as best I can from Du Bois and others. On one hand, the pull toward the Negro tradition, even to the sense of Africa standing behind the American Negro. The pull toward a cultural identity in terms of Negro-ness, or in terms toward the exclusive based on the sense of race, whatever race means.
Mm-hmm.
Or in contemporary terms, as Africa begins to be reorganized in national states, and since discussion of Negro culture or cultures, the sense of negritude that is a mystique noir. These things, all these are one pull on one side, the aspects of it. All black Muslim beliefs are still on that side. On the other hand, the impulse to move into the Western tradition, the Western culture, the Western religion, as it appears in Europe and in America, and in the end, by integration, perhaps to lose the Negro identity entirely. Even the bloodstream would disappear, to be absorbed into some new cultural and biological synthesis with the identity gone. These two impulses. Now, how much of a problem is this in your observation or in your feelings? For some Negroes, it's a fundamental problem. For some, it's no problem at all. They can have an overarching resolution of some sort for it, or an undergirding resolution for it. How do you feel about it?
Just as a matter of interest to you, I think I've read almost everything that Du Bois wrote until he became a very old man. He's a graduate of Fisk University, incidentally.
Yes.
I think the most universal urge of American Negroes is to become identified completely with the total culture, the total aspirations, the total values of this country. You're not so much aware of that as you are or until you visit an African country, for instance, as I have. There's been in the history of Negroes in this country, of course, some streams, some splits that would go in other directions. But if you talk to almost any sample of Negroes, of whatever level, or across the board, I think, without any doubt, this is what you will find to be the dominant motif, the dominant mystique, and that the exception are the other multiple aspirations to which you alluded.
Now, here is something else. It may be a verbal difficulty, though apparently for some people it's not merely verbal. This desire to participate in the American and Western European cultural tradition to the fullest extent. What does this mean about the sense of Negro identity and even the new sense of the personal image as Negro? You see what I'm getting at?
Yes. Now, this is a more
difficult. How do we put these things together?
This is a more difficult and more subtle question. I'm by no means sure that the subculture is going to survive, or that there is any strong feeling on the part of the great majority of the people to see to it that it survives. Let me illustrate what I'm talking about. When I grew up as a boy, there was a great deal more emphasis upon being a Negro than there is now. I remember in schools we sang almost every day, and so frequently, it seems to me now every day, this Lift Every Voice and Sing, the James Weldon Johnson piece. There was a great deal of emphasis upon the history of Negroes, the heroes, if you will, of the struggle. I can talk to typical college students here at Fisk University right now, and very many of them have no knowledge, or very little knowledge, of who the people were who have been responsible for moving the group ahead as to the extent that it has been moved ahead. And unless something concrete and systematic is done, there's going to be less of this carrot forward. I talked, for instance, to four of our youngsters who went to Scandinavia, the Scandinavian countries last summer. And one of the things we thought that they should be conversing with would be the history of Negroes in this country, who some of the dominant writers are, what the differences are between Urban League, NAACP, CORE, what have you, who the people were who were the antecedents of these groups. And you would have been astonished at how little they knew about this. Now that doesn't mean, though, if I may just add one other thing, and I'm really arriving at this principle.
Yes.
To the extent, I think, that the barriers, I'm speaking of the walls of segregation now, are kept tight, and there is an ingrownness among the Negro group, to the extent that this is done, will there be a continuation of this sense of identity, the Negro-ness, as you said? But
this is contingent upon the pressures of segregation.
That's right. But as these pressures weaken, there is going to be, in my opinion, less and less and less of this. Now, that doesn't mean that to the extent that, this is a corollary of the same thing, and I need not even mention it. But this is a conviction I have about it.
But now, how does that relate? And I certainly don't have any notion that it relates to the idea, which is very current now, that the, quotes, new Negro, that the cutting edge of the civil rights movement among Negroes is based on a new conception of the self as Negro, of identity, of the Negro identity, opposed to the old notion of the white stereotype of the Negro.
I don't believe that there's a great deal of credence that can be attached to this.
Really?
I have a feeling that what the Negroes, particularly the young ones now I'm speaking of, want above everything else is to be an American citizen with the opportunity to look with real hope and expectation to the right to be one in all respects, to live his life as he sees it, and to have the opportunity to do so. This, to me, is the thing that I sense among them. I don't get the feeling, and I think if you just had the time, it'd be wonderful if you could talk to some of our young people.
I would like very much to, and I want to come back. I've been seeing a good many college students, and my time got out of hand here on this basis. I would like nothing better than to do that. I want to arrange that. I'm coming back to that.
Because what you are getting from me is an interpretation of what I think I sense. But I think they would be able to give you what they themselves feel and what they themselves are aspiring to. You can talk to them. And as these pressures to stay in a particular place are removed,
you mean a social place?
I mean a racial place.
Yeah, well, social and racial.
Right. They behave and their aspirations reach without reference to identity. See, being a Negro doesn't involve a religion in the sense that there is a religion involved in among Jews. There is something there that ties them to a religion and a heritage which I think is deeper than anything that characterizes Negroes in America, because you can find them identified in almost every religious denomination in this country. And they know no other. They know no other aspirations. They come through the school system using the same textbooks, read the same newspapers, watch the same television shows. Everything that is America has its bearing, its force upon them.
I have talked with several Negroes of high intelligence and education who have said to me that they have systematically put a discipline on themselves to abolish the symbolism in the language and all life around them of white values, white and equaling light and joy and purity, and black as the opposite of these things. It's a systematic attempt to discipline themselves out of this symbolism.
If you mean the sheer stereotype.
I'm sorry. This is the end of the first tape of Dr. Stephen Wright. Continue on tape 2.